This audio is provided without charge by Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia, which reserves all rights. Please visit givewts.com to learn how you can support Westminster or contact communications at wts.edu for more information.
My name is Flavien Pardigon. And if you didn't get that, that's an F on the exam. I'm a graduate of this school, of this wonderful place. I'm actually not really a church historian. I'm more of a theologian. And I happen to be a citizen of the same country as Calvin. So I guess that qualifies me as a specialist. Well, one advantage of that, of course, is I can read Calvin in the original. And that's a good help. I'm basically a missionary. I'm traveling to different parts of the world to train pastors and church leaders. And so I'm glad to be here today. I'm glad to be in this class. I'm not used to teaching large groups of people with laptops and all those things. I'm used to teaching small groups of people with no electricity. So you will forgive me if sometimes I sound a bit... a bit simplistic or more like a church small group. It's just that's what I'm used to. I'm actually expecting you to interact with me. Okay? Ask questions. Interfere. But please talk to me. If you don't, I'll feel really weird. And I might ask questions, and some of those questions will be rhetorical. But some of those questions will be real questions. I'll be waiting for an answer. And if none of you would know me, I don't think that any of you would have had a lecture with me. I'll sit and wait for you to answer. Literally. So this morning, we will be speaking about Calvin's doctrine of the Lord's Supper. This is a very important subject. And it is a very good way to enter into some of the heart of Calvin's theology and some of what's really motivating him in his ministry and in his teaching. So it's a good way to get a sense of who Calvin was, what was going on around him, and what was driving him in what he was doing. It is also an important subject simply because I believe, and Calvin believed, that the sacraments, and especially the Lord's Supper, were at the heart of the Christian life, were at the heart of the life of the church, the ministry of the church, the ministry of the gospel. This is not a secondary subject that you study at the end of your systematic theology just because, with the miscellany, we've dealt with what was really significant, and now we have all those little subjects we've got to deal with, but, let's move on. Now, for Calvin, that's where everything is going. So, let's get a little bit of context. Now, I checked with one of the students, and I was told that Dr. Truman, yesterday... dealt a bit with Luther and Zwingli and the controversy between them. Would any of you be able to summarize that in a few sentences? Just give us a snapshot of what was going on, what was key to Luther's thought, what was key to Zwingli's thought, and why they couldn't get along, why they could not agree. Who was present yesterday?
Doctrine was saying how Luther is one of the last of the medievals, and because of that background, he really had a dualistic sense of sacraments, of how important it is, and how important it is for Jesus' body to be really present in that activity, where Zwingli came from more of a humanist approach, especially with the new revivalism coming on. So he was a city man, so therefore he saw it more as a symbolic approach in a way to get our minds to reflect back on what Christ was in that experiential time. So that's kind of the main thing that he laid out.
Okay. Anything else that you think would be significant?
I think we saw the sacraments as having a kind of a horizontal focus, binding believers together. We're told, whereas Luther saw more as vertical, God coming down to man. Mm-hmm.
Did you get into the controversy, what the arguments they use one with the other? Do you remember what passages they would have been discussing, like biblical passages?
Hoc est meum corpus, Luther just writing it on top. This is my body, it says this is my body, so it just must mean this is my body. And then Zwingli said, well, no, we have to understand it's a symbolic use of language here.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
And which part of a verse did Zwingli use to defend that?
I believe it's John 6:63. I'm not sure. It was from the meetings.
Mm-hmm. It suggests John 6.
Do this in remembrance of me.
Do this in remembrance of me. So you have Luther insisting on the... on that particular verse saying, this is my body. Of course, he's basing his argument on the Latin, which has the verb. If you check the Greek in the Gospels, there's no verb. It's implied. But he's insisting on this. This is, and he wants to avoid any kind of exegesis that would be, or interpretation that would not measure the full weight of that expression, and that this is this identity between the element and the body, between the bread and the body and the wine and the blood. For him, as you can probably guess, a key issue is how you read the scriptures and what you do with scriptures. Another thing which was mentioned before is an issue of Christology. On that particular aspect, he's approaching it from a medieval, scholastic, realistic angle, which is, how can this piece of bread be literally the body of Christ? How does it work ontologically? How does it work for this thing which, when I taste it, still tastes like bread, still feels like bread, to be the actual body of Christ? Zwingli, who maybe reacts more negatively to Roman Catholic sacramental practices, and realizes that the Roman Catholic doctrine of the transubstantiation is just an idolatrous thing, doesn't want to hear about that. That's one thing. However, he's still caught a bit in that mode of thinking. So unlike Luther, who wants to maintain the physical, real presence of Christ in the sacrament, Zwingli thinks that he must get rid of it. Do you see a bit how they use somewhat the same logic and patterns, except that one comes, I want to keep it, so I'll go with this consubstantiation theory. The other one says, I don't want to have anything to do with it. Now, this is not completely true. Zwingli is usually represented as teaching that the sacrament is a strictly psychological, emotional thing, where I remember Christ, and as I remember Christ and his sacrifice, I am being encouraged in my faith, I am being strengthened in my faith, and all those things. This is not completely true. There are signs that Zwingli recognized that there was something more happening in the sacrament. He speaks of the sacrament as being like a tinderbox that produces a spark. So it seems that Zwingli did see some kind of action of God, some kind of supernatural dimension to the sacrament, but he separated completely from the physical, real presence of Christ. For him, that's got nothing to do with the body of Christ. But they both think along the same, or with the same kind of patterns of concepts. They look at the issue a bit the same way. They just come to a different conclusion, but for the same reasons, in a sense. Calvin, who like Zwingli is more of a Renaissance man, is more a humanist, will approach it very differently. Remember that Luther is a monk. Remember that he was trained as a monk and as a teacher in the Catholic Church. Remember that Zwingli was a priest. He also was trained in the Catholic Church. Calvin is not. Calvin never went to seminary. Calvin studied law. His family is from the northern part of France, which we call Picardy. And his father was a faithful Catholic and was a faithful servant of the church. And because of that, Calvin did get some church benefits. In other words, he had an income coming from some kind of chapel. But he himself was never a church man in terms of the Roman Catholic Church. He went to study in the Paris region and in Paris itself. I won't get into the geography of France. I think that we can pass on that. But basically the broader region around Paris and then Paris itself. And he studied law. And he was involved with a bad gang. He was involved with people who were challenging the thinking of the day and who were, in particular, challenging the teaching of the, at the time, the one big university, which still exists, called La Sorbonne, which is in Paris, which at the time was under the rule of the Catholic Church. And those men are true humanists. So now, what I assume you've heard the expression. I assume most of you know what that means, but I still think it's important to explain a bit what that term means. When we talk about humanism in the 16th century, we're not talking about modern, like the Humanist Manifesto. It's not a philosophical theory that centers upon man. Humanism has to do with the humanities, which are probably what we would call today social studies. Of course, at the time, they didn't have sociology and psychology and all those things. What they understood as humanities were philosophy, languages, and things like that. And in the 16th century, late 15th, early 16th century, there's a revival of this kind of studies, studying languages, rediscovering languages, discovering original authors, especially classics, Latin authors, Greek authors. And that leads to a very different a culture, a very different mindset. And that group is starting to challenge medieval thinking, scholastic thinking. In fact, they're rejecting it. Now, you have to realize that as they do that, originally, at first, it's pretty hush-hush. They don't go out and broadcast what they're doing because they know they would get in serious trouble. So a lot of that is done in the classroom or in discussions outside of the classroom, and it's pretty quiet. And then Calvin gets involved with a group that will get in serious trouble. I don't know if you've heard of that story, but at some point, I should say one thing before about this group that Calvin is involved with. They're not only humanists, but they're actually reading Luther. They are very interested in what Luther is saying. You also have to realize that Luther's early years, Luther himself hasn't yet come to what we would call a reformational position. If you ever read the 95 Theses, you realize that this is not yet Protestant justification issues. I mean, Luther is concerned about purely internal Roman Catholic issues, and in particular the practice of indulgences and things like that. But he's not yet questioning the soteriology of the Catholic Church. That will take some time. Now, there's a big debate among scholars as to when Luther had his conversion or came to a full understanding of justification by faith. There's a whole debate about that. I won't get into it. But you have to know that in the early years, he himself is in process. And he's not the only one in Europe. I'm sure that Dr. Truman has talked about how there were people all over Europe coming up with the same kind of ideas and same kind of questions and same kind of challenges. And so there's, you know, it's bubbling. It's simmering a bit everywhere in Europe. And in France, the group that Calvin is involved with, the Groupe de Meaux, in French, and I don't know how to pronounce that in English, forget. that group is on the cutting edge, if you'd like. They're humanists. They hear of Luther and other people, and they're interested in those ideas, and they're thinking about it, talking about it, try to measure the consequences, what the implications. And so the Reformation starts to take ground in France at the same time. And of course, it's too early. There's no Reformed church. There's no Reformed in the sense of Calvinist churches. But there are churches that are very influenced by Luther and other thinkers. And people start believing this stuff. But they also start being persecuted for it. And what happens is that a group of them decides to convince the king that they are faithful citizens and that he should leave them alone. Okay? And so they have the grand idea of entering into the king's bedroom and tack a note on his bed frame asking him to recognize that they are faithful citizens and that, or subjects to be exact, and that he should be, you know, he should not fear them. Well, guess what? When he wakes up, he freaks out. And, you know, remember, we're late 15th century, early 16th century. It's not the same time as today. You don't take disagreement lightly, especially when it has to do with religion, because that also challenges the power of the king and all this kind of thing. So heretics are brutally repressed at the time. And the early Reformation people, they're not the only ones questioning the Catholic Church. They're not the only ones threatening it. And so they're not the only ones being persecuted for it. So the king freaks out. And somehow his secret services figure out that the people who are behind it are connected to that particular group in Meaux. And though, again, we don't know much about Calvin's involvement in this particular situation, because Calvin is very quiet upon his life. He doesn't say anything. We don't even know when he was converted. Likelihood that he was connected to the people who did that, maybe not as he was involved in the plot, but he knew them, and he realizes that when the king and his people are going after those guys, he's on the list. Even if he didn't participate, he's on the list. So he actually, that's when he runs away and flees from Paris and from France. That's when his exile starts. Not clear exactly where he stands in his faith, but he's involved enough, and he's connected enough with this group that he feels that he has to go. Some people are arrested. They're being judged. Some of them are killed. He runs away, and he will, I wouldn't say he will never return to France. He will, on one or two occasions, discreetly get back into France. But basically, he's in exile for the rest of his life. So that's a bit the context where, you know, where he's coming from. Now, do you know what his first published book is?
Commentary on
Absolutely. So it's a very typical classics study. He's taking one of the main classical authors, and he's taking one of his books, the De Clemencia, I believe, and he writes a commentary on that book. It's actually a very interesting reading, because you can start to see how his exegetical method is being developed and how he will approach the study of scripture, you know, going back to the original languages and all this stuff. It's pretty amazing. So he's got a runaway. Now, as these things happen, Luther and Zwingli get involved in a controversy, and especially around the Lord's Supper. Now, you know, remember, it's 16th century Europe. There's no internet. There's no email. There's no website. There's no telephone. Communication is not easy. Books are not very easy to get by, especially when those books are banned by the church and by most kings. So you have people carrying books all over Europe, peddlers basically, selling those books. When they get caught, they get in serious trouble, and so on. But there's still a network, there's still an exchange of information and books and ideas that is happening, and most of the key leaders know each other. At least they know of each other. They may never have met, but they know of each other. And in that context, two of the prominent figures, two figures that emerge of that group and become a bit more of a poles around which most other people will revolve, are Luther and Zwingli. Okay? And they're both very strong personalities. I mean, very, very strong. And they're both pretty, they've got a good fighting spirit. If you've ever read Luther, he's got a pretty fiery way of speaking, especially of people who disagree with him. And Zwingli, Zwingli died on the battlefield, okay? He was the priest of his city. We became the pastor. But he also was one of the main military leaders of that city. And he died on the battlefield. Not exactly tame people. So, and also, 16th century, when you have arguments, disagreements, polemics, tempers flare up. And the language is pretty... I don't know exactly what word I should use. It's flowery, but with a lot of thorns. And so, you know, people get a bit incensed. And there's, so there's the controversy is becoming pretty, is getting serious, is getting divisive, not only for those two men, but basically for the whole group of for the early Reformation believers and leaders. It's, to use Calvin's language, it's rending the body of Christ asunder. So they finally decide to get together and try to hammer out their differences. That's the that's when they meet in Marburg in 1529. And I'll start giving you a few dates. Don't worry, I won't give you many dates because I can't remember them. So 1529, Luther and Zwingli get together, and of course they're not alone, with a bunch of other people, for the Marburg Colloquium, trying to come to an agreement on the Lord's Supper. That doesn't work. They actually leave that colloquium even more angry at each other than before. And it is really dividing a church that is spread out through Europe and is under a lot of pressure, and therefore it's actually threatening its survival. I mean, we don't realize how serious it is. You have a Luther who's locked up basically in the town of Wittenberg, because if he steps out, he's fair game. Anybody can kill him and get money for that. And we have to realize that. Calvin is the same situation once he gets to Geneva, he will be basically closed up in the area of Geneva and Neuchâtel and Lausanne. And he won't really be able to travel much because the same thing, he's fair game. You know, there's a price. There's a reward for getting him, dead or alive, wanted. But the church itself is under a lot of pressure. And when you're a minority and you're being oppressed, the only way you can survive is what? Each man goes his own way? How do you survive? You stick together. And remember that the Catholic Church, one way the Catholic Church is arguing for kings and leaders to destroy those heretics is because they are schismatics. They've cut themselves off from the church. They are destroying the body of Christ. They're threatening peace and unity of the kingdoms and empire, German empire and so on. Well, if they get divided, that's confirming that they're right. We cannot get along and we're just divisive people. We're just schismatics at heart. But if you want to survive, and that's the case for those guys, you have to stick together. That's the only way you can maintain an existence in this era. So it's very serious. That's about the time when Calvin gets in trouble. And that's close to when he would have had his conversion. Now, as I said, we don't really know when that happened. In one of his, I think it's in the introduction to one of his commentaries, he makes a passing comment on when that might have happened. And that would be when he was around 25, so that means in 34, 1534. But again, that's a passing comment. It's not clear whether that's decisive or not. But that's when he is converted. And then the first edition of the Institutes is what year? Do you know?
36.
The guy is 27 years old, and he's publishing one of the most significant theological work in 1500 years. Probably was converted relatively shortly before that, but has been involved with humanist thinking and reformational thinking before. So 1536 is his first edition. It's pretty short, I mean, compared to the final edition of the Institutes. And it pretty much follows Luther's catechism, which himself follows a very traditional format, you know, with the Apostles' Creeds and the law, the Lord's Prayer, and those kind of things. It's pretty standard. And Calvin sticks to that. In the later editions, he will move a bit more away from that structure. So the first edition is in 1536. He also publishes in those years a short catechism. And that same year, he arrives in Geneva. Now, he's actually going through Geneva. He's coming back from Italy, and he's trying to go to Strasbourg. Okay? Just as a geographical precision, Strasbourg is now part of France, but at the time it was some kind of an independent like city-state between France and Germany, so between the Kingdom of France and the German Empire, the Holy German Empire. And he wants to go there because he's heard of Martin Bucer, and he wants to be there. He also wants to do further studies and things like that. So he stops in Geneva on his way, like he stops at the hotel. And Guillaume Farel, or in English William Farel, Guillaume Farel hears, who is the pastor in town, hears that this brilliant young man is in town. And so he finds him. He finds the inn in which he's staying, has a long talk with him where he's trying to convince him to stay in Geneva and help him establish a reformed church in this town. Now, a couple of precisions about this. Reformed here means doesn't mean reformed in Calvinistic sense, you know, reformed by contrast with Lutheran. What it means is a church that has been reformed, re-established, purified. Okay? Another one is that Geneva was also a sort of, was a city-state, and the lord of that city-state was a, I can't remember now if it's a bishop or an archbishop. So there was a very strong confusion between church and political matters in town. And the Genevans were pretty, how to describe them? Let's say they strongly resented that stuff. They wanted to be able to do what they wanted. They wanted to be able not to pay their taxes to that guy, but especially for the wealthy ones, they wanted to keep that money for themselves. They also wanted to have the freedom to do whatever they wanted, and including gambling and going to the inns to drink too much and all this stuff. Playing cards, poker. I mean, it wasn't poker, but same kind of games. And things like that. So they actually end up getting rid of their... I think he's on a mission somewhere else, and they pretty much tell him, don't come back. And that's when Farel becomes the leader of the church. But he knows that, you know, this is really, anything could happen. For one thing, Geneva is threatened by France, by Savoy, by different countries that are Catholic, and that would really like to take control of Geneva and get its wealth. The other thing is, he knows that the people are whimsical, you know? They might change their mind. Especially when they see the armies of the King of France or somebody else coming up, they might just say, okay, we're fine, we're Catholic again. Please come back. So he knows that the Reformation is not well established, that they haven't really... it's not because they want to have a pure church, even if they talk about reforming the church. It's for different reasons that they've got rid of their Roman Catholic leadership. So he wants to impress on Calvin how urgent and important it is for him to, for Calvin to help Farel establish a solid church in Geneva. Calvin doesn't want to stay. That's not on his agenda. That's not his plan. He wants to go on, continue his studies. He wants to stay away from controversies and too much trouble. And he wants to go to Strasbourg. Well, Farel, out of sheer frustration, and I guess today we would call that... spiritual abuse, stands up, and it's you know, I guess there's Beza, Theodore of Beza is actually the one telling that story. He may be embellishing it a bit, but basically standing up and thundering tells him, if you know, young man, if you leave this town, God will curse you, and leaves. Calvin is so struck by that he'll stay. He'll change his mind and stay. He and Farel will be laboring in Geneva for about 2 years before they're kicked out. They are banned, exiled, thrown out. The reason is that, well, there are several reasons. One of them is they want the church to be independent from the political power. They want church authorities to be able to lead the church, decide for the church, and among other things, decide the form of worship, and be in charge of what we would call discipline. The town councils don't want to hear about that. The wealthy men of Geneva don't want to hear about that. They want to remain in charge. Many reasons for that. For one thing, again, we're in the 16th century. Secularization hasn't happened yet. So the distinction between religion, politics, culture, all those things doesn't exist. You know, it's all one big thing. That's one issue. So the second issue is some of those men don't want to have to give an answer to any kind of religious leadership because they'd get in trouble. Another thing is Geneva is a small city-state. It doesn't have much power to stand on its own. It has powerful neighbors who would be very glad to take control. So they actually depend on some of the other cities around, and in particular, Bern, B-E-R-N. And Bern and the cities or territories that are under its rule are Protestant. They're not Catholic. But they're not led by Calvin or Farel. They're under a different leadership, and they have different ideas. And so the leadership of Geneva, the Council of Geneva, will comply to the ways of Bern to keep them happy and to have an ally that can help them, which is a bit of a slap in the face to Calvin and Farel. And so Calvin and Farel complain, and complain somewhat loudly. They're given 3 days to leave town. Now, there's a level at which they probably asked for it. They did complain. They were barred from preaching, and they did anyway. The council told them, you know, Easter was coming, Easter Sunday, and said, you cannot preach. And they said, yeah, right. They preached on Easter. Now, they didn't give the Lord's Supper because of what was going on. And they said, you know, we're all too incensed with what's going on. That would be a good time to take communion, so we won't do that. But they did preach, even though they were barred by the councils of the city. So they were given 3 days to leave. They first go to Lausanne. They go to complain to the Bernese authorities. But eventually, that doesn't go anywhere. And so Calvin leaves for Strasbourg. And Farel is called to pastor a church in Neuchâtel, another Swiss town, French-speaking town. So Calvin goes and spends about, we're in 1538, okay? So Calvin arrives in Geneva in 36. In 38, he and Farel are kicked out. He goes to Strasbourg, and there in Strasbourg, he pastors a French-speaking church. You have to know that Strasbourg is actually German-speaking. So he's ministering to refugees, to French people who are fleeing France and find asylum in Strasbourg. And so he's ministering to them, but he's ministering under Bucer in many ways. So Bucer is a bit of a mentor to him during that time, and he discusses a lot with Bucer. About 3 years later, things change in Geneva a bit, and the Genevan authorities send a delegation to Calvin and ask him to come back. Negotiations happen. He accepts in the end, and so in 1541, he comes back to Geneva and takes up his position again. An interesting aspect, an interesting anecdote, is that, as you probably know, Calvin was preaching in Lectio Continua style, which means he took a book of the Bible and preached through it, verse by verse. Well, the first Sunday of his preaching, he just picks up where he stopped 3 years before, just like nothing happened. And I believe he was in the book of Psalms at the time. Just the next verse and continues like nothing happened. He will be there till his death in 1564. So 23, 24 more years of service there. He will never be able to wrench the shepherding or directing of the church out of the hands of the political power in Geneva. That will be one of the big battles that he will never win. The councils will always control everything that happens in the church, which means a couple things. For one thing, that means the pastors need to get permission from the councils to do anything. But it also means that whatever church policies are enacted are actually laws of the land. That's a bit of a strange thing. It's as if your church bylaws or, you know, were enacted, approved, established as laws of the land by, what would it be, the House of Representatives? Pretty strange, but that's the way it was there. Which meant that if you got into trouble with the church, you got in trouble with the state too. And punishment was not just ecclesiastical. And that's why a heretic like Servetus was burned at the stake. That's why some people were excommunicated and banned at the same time.
I know it might be conjecture, but do you think that those penalties might not have been carried out had Calvin succeeded in
control? It's hard to tell because, you know, it's as I said, it's a bit speculative because that's the way it was. So it's kind of hard to think what would have happened otherwise. It's hard to tell. Because obviously, Calvin will make use of that at some points. He will go to the councils and ask them to act on some issues, especially when he's facing some opposition from a variety of people. So he will make use of that that lever to get his way also. Now, is it just because, well, that's the way it was, so that's what he used to get to that point? And if it had been different, he would have done it differently? It's hard to tell because obviously we don't know. I mean, I said Calvin was a man of his time in many ways, but at the same time, he wanted the church to be separated, and he wanted to distinguish between the spiritual realm and the political realm to some extent. We will never know exactly to what extent. So I wouldn't speculate too much on what would have happened if. One thing that, I mean, well, that's one thing that would have happened is that discipline would have been an ecclesiastical matter. That's definitely what Calvin had in mind. He wanted that. He wanted to be able to decide if scandalous people were, if needed to be barred from the supper and things like that, which he was never able to. He always had to go through the consistory or the different councils of Geneva. And of course, when you're trying to discipline a member of that council, you don't go very far. Calvin's time in Geneva is not easy. He faces a lot of opposition from powerful people, but also from simple people. He and, in fact, Farel, in the early days also, they were not always very wise in the way they were trying to move things. But, you know, again, I mean, they were trying to create something out of the blue. They didn't have any pattern. They didn't have any example they could use before. They were just trying to do it. So they were not always wise, and that led to some frustration and conflict, which led to their first, I mean, to their exile in the first place. But then even afterwards, when he came back, Calvin was probably more feared than loved by the people of Geneva, by his flock. Another anecdote, and I can't remember who mentions that. I don't know if it's Beza or somebody else. When the story goes that when Calvin was walking down the streets to go somewhere, the Genevans would send their dogs after him. So that was not necessarily the best pastoral relationship ever. At the same time, when you're the pastor of a whole city, you know, it's not like you can be friendly to anyone. So in terms of the Lord's Supper, in all these things, in those different steps, the Lord's Supper is always at the heart of what's going on a bit and some of the challenges. You see, one of the conflict he has with the city revolves around ordering the church and ordering worship, especially the sacraments, which entails discipline. The reformers talked about the marks of the true church. I mean, you've heard of that, I'm sure. Do you remember how many Luther or Calvin would identify? What would be the marks of a true church? What would be the things that were absolutely necessary for a church to be a church of Jesus Christ and not a synagogue of Satan?
Preaching
preaching and sacraments. Now, if you look at the Westminster Confession, you'll see that there are three. What would be the third?
Discipline.
It's not that Calvin didn't believe that discipline was an important part. In fact, that's probably what he got in trouble for most of the time. It's just that for him, in his thinking, that's part of the sacrament. That's part of the ministry of the word. It's not a distinct element. Pierre Viret, another reformer of the same time, but pastor of the church in Lausanne, is the one who actually started distinguishing the three. He actually has writings about discipline as such. I don't know if they've been translated into English, but if you look, Viret is spelled V-I-R-E-T. You might look online and find things about him. But he's the first one to start to really identify and develop discipline as a distinct aspect of the ministry of the church and as a mark of the church. But it was included for Calvin and Luther into their understanding of the sacraments. So this is really like a red thread in the life of Calvin and in many of the writings of Calvin and in many of his controversies, in many of his decisions, in many of his struggles. Again, that may sound strange to us because we're so used to think of the Lord's Supper or baptism and those issues as being secondary or practical issues where they're not that significant as long as we have the gospel, as long as we have justification, we're fine. But that's not the case for Calvin. That's not the case for Luther. That's not the case for Zwingli. That's not the case for any of the reformers. For them, worship is what matters. The whole point of the Reformation is to restore true worship of God. The Reformation of the church is that it would be able to fulfill its essential role, its essential duty, which is to worship God in a what we today we would call a biblical manner, in a true way, in a way that honors God, that is faithful to His will. And at the heart of this worship is obviously the preaching of the word and the sacraments. These are not secondary issues for the reformers, any of them. These are primary, essential issues. This is what the Reformation is about. I don't know if I should get into one of my pet peeves, but when we talk about the Reformation, especially the Calvinist Reformation, you will often find people who say, this was all about X, Y, or Z. Sovereignty of God, justification by faith, this, and that. Usually we identify particular doctrinal points and say, this was really the heart of it. This was what it was all about, you know, election. And you'll find a number of modern scholars who will do that. But that's not the Reformation. Obviously, the Reformation was very concerned about proper doctrine, especially related to the person and the work of Christ and the salvation of His people. But it's because this is the foundation, or this is the substance that produces true worship. But the heart of the matter for them is the church. Their concern is the church as a community of people, as a people, but also as an institution. And in particular, as a worshiping institution. And that is definitely true of Calvin. That's true of Luther, you know, the Babylonian captivity of the church. His point is we need to free the church from those false teachings and practices that prevent it from being a true church and therefore to worship God properly. So if you look at the final edition of the Institutes, how many books? 4. Which is the longest of the 4? The fourth. What is in the fourth? Church. And if you look carefully, you'll see that one scholar says that I haven't checked myself, I haven't counted the pages, but somebody said that about 40% of the book 4 is about the sacraments. And if I remember correctly, you said that that's about 14% of the entire Institutes, just about the sacraments. If you want to know about Calvin's views of the sacraments and you want to read primary sources, you're going to have to read all of Calvin's works. Don't think that you can read the Institutes and have the full thing. You'll have to read he wrote at least 2 catechisms. One is an early one, pretty short, very simple for children. And then he also wrote what is known as the Geneva Catechism, which is much more substantial. That's that book. I don't remember the exact number of questions and answer. 371. Remember, kids, memorize that. He obviously wrote the Institutes. He has a number of letters and controversies about this. He wrote what is known as the Confessio Gallicana, which is the French Confession of 1559. He actually writes the draft for it. The pastors in France modify a bit the early chapters, but it's basically Calvin's text that we have today. But also, he will write about the sacraments in his commentaries, biblical commentaries. Now, of course, we would expect him to talk about the sacraments in 1 Corinthians 11, you know, in the Gospels, the Last Supper, and all these kind of things. Of course, but he doesn't just do that. He speaks about the sacraments frequently in his commentaries, even in the Old Testament. He will frequently come back to the sacraments and what is being taught in that particular Old Testament book means for the sacraments, or how it's connected to issues related to sacraments. It's everywhere. It's peppered everywhere. So you might ask, well, where do we get the kind of the summary statement? His vision statement or whatever, his mission statement. Where does he get the, you know, 3-sentence description of it? Well, for one thing, Calvin is not a thinker that, you know, obviously he's not a modern thinker. He doesn't think he needs to write everything in 3 points. He doesn't think that he needs to write short sentences. You know, most of his sentences are like a paragraph long. I don't know of any one place where you could get a one-paragraph full expression of his doctrine. Now, if you go to the catechisms, for example, or the French Confession of 1559, you can see a pretty short expression of his doctrine. But that's only a partial expression of it. It's only a few elements that are important for that particular writing, for that particular context, for what he's trying to achieve. The Confession of 1559 had a dual purpose. And by the way, Calvin didn't think it was, he didn't want it. He wrote the draft because he realized that they were going to do it anyway, even though he thought it was not the right time to do it. So he wrote a draft very quickly so that they would have, the pastors in France would have a good base to start from. He thought that they were not ready, that actually the Reformed churches were not ready yet to produce a confession of faith of that kind. But there were 2 purposes in it. The first one was to unify churches give them something that brings them together. And so it is a it's a really a consensus document in a sense, in that it's really trying to lay out the bare minimum beliefs, what you know we really all share together, and that's what makes us what we are. That's the first one. So it's not a very detailed and developed confession of faith. It's actually in its final form, it's 40 paragraphs. Some paragraphs being one or two sentences long, very short. It's very compact. The other purpose of that is to demonstrate to the King of France of the time, Francis I, not the Pope, the King of France, that Reformed believers are, one, true Christians, they're not heretics, and two, faithful subjects. In fact, there are a few paragraphs that deal with the relationship of the church to the state, to the king, and how we're supposed to obey him and stuff like that. And it's an appeal to the king to say, I guess it's what they tried a few years back with a different king, posting something in his bedroom. This time they do it as a public document. And so the confession is not there to handle all the controversies. It's not there to handle all the details, and it's not giving us all the nuances and subtleties of it. It is useful, but it's not necessarily the final form. The Institutes gives you a lot more. Obviously, it's much longer. It's a few hundred pages on the sacraments. But it's also more controversial. It's more polemical. In the Institutes, Calvin is very concerned to show how the Catholic Church is unfaithful, how its view of worship is idolatrous, how its understanding of the sacraments, especially the Lord's Supper, is idolatrous and unacceptable. So a lot of it has to do with attacking the Catholic Church and attacking its doctrine and its practice. So you don't necessarily get much more precision as to Calvin's positive understanding of it. You get a lot more of, this is what I don't believe, and why. I mean, you do get more, obviously, than in those statements. Then, in later years, Calvin will get into a somewhat sustained controversy with some Lutheran theologians. So not Luther. Luther is dead. But after Luther is dead, he gets into controversy, especially with one man called Westphal. Westphal. And in these exchanges, Calvin will clarify his meaning on a number of points. He won't succeed in convincing Westphal that his doctrine is correct, but he at least it's a good place to go to get some precision as to what he means by this or that. And how is it different from the Lutheran doctrine? Because you'll see that, in fact, Calvin's doctrine is a lot closer, in a sense, to Luther's doctrine than to Zwingli's. But the irony of history is that Calvin will be able to iron out an agreement with the Zwinglians, but not with the Lutherans. That's one of the ironies of history. That's another place. Now, I'll tell you, my favorite statement of Calvin's doctrine of the Lord's Supper is a short treatise that he published in 1541. What happened that year? 1541? He returns to Geneva. One of the first things in terms of writing that he does when he's in Geneva is publish this short treatise on the Lord's Supper. Which means that he'd been writing on it, he'd be writing it and working on it before. Well, when would that be? What was the context in which he would have written it? In exile. And where was that exile? Strasbourg. When he was working under Butzer. Butzer, who is, well, Butzer is, he's a Butzerite. He's his own kind of brand. But would be quite close to Luther and early Lutheran theology. He's German-speaking. They're basically neighbors. Obviously, he would be very influenced by that. In fact, there is a good likelihood that Bucer helped Calvin understand Luther himself better. So he's been writing on it when he was in Strasbourg, comes to Geneva, and the first thing he publishes is that treatise on the Lord's Supper. I don't think it just happened by chance. And that treatise is a gem. It's a treasure. Beza, I don't know if you know Theodore of Beza. Beza was, right, he's got a long history. He was a poet. He became a pastor under Calvin. He succeeded to Calvin as the pastor of Geneva when Calvin died. He wrote a life of Calvin, which is very fun to read, where he can't find any fault in the man. But you learn a lot about the life of Calvin through Beza. And in this, he talks about this short treatise as being a golden nugget, the golden gem. It is just, it's an incredible piece. And I would agree with him. I have a copy of it here in French. That particular booklet, I mean, it's pretty short. You know, it's not a very long book. In this format, it's about 60 pages, not even that. Let's say 50 pages. Is a treasure of theology, but also of pedagogy. I'm sorry, I don't put the stress on the right syllable, but it's also an incredible piece of, not polemic in the sense of fighting, but of handling disagreement with people whom you honor, who in a sense you consider as being your superiors, and yet whom you think are not only making a mistake theologically, but are sinning in their behavior. That short treatise, in that short treatise, Calvin exposes his doctrine, explains it in a language that is at the same time simple. It's meant to be understandable by your average churchgoer, and at the same time substantial and poetic. I mean, I won't hide to you. I'm very. I think that's my favorite writing of Calvin. Of anything he's written, that's what I like the most. In that book, he will go over the doctrine. He will go over some of the controversies. He will go over what it's meant to do to Christians. So it's a bit also of catechism and encouragement, exhortation. But he will also talk about Luther and Zwingli and how they failed. And very humbly indicate that he thinks that his doctrine and his approach not only is true when the other ones were wrong, but could have brought them together. Now, there is some indication that before his death, Luther would have had access to some of Calvin's writings on the sacrament, and that he would have said, in his opinion, that if Calvin or somebody with the same doctrine had been present at the Marburg colloquium, he and Zwingli would have found a way to agree. They would have come together. well, we don't know for Zwingli himself, but Bullinger, who succeeds, takes the church after Zwingli dies in Zurich, he and Calvin will interact a lot, and they will come to an agreement called the Consensus Tigurinus in 1559. And at that point, all the churches in Switzerland, all the Protestant churches in Switzerland, will have an agreement that brings them together on that issue. However, if Luther would have been happy with Calvin's doctrine, his successors in the Lutheran world didn't. And in fact, some of the language used in the Consensus Tigurinus with Bullinger will offend them even more and will alienate them even more. And so the gap will be increased. I haven't heard the bell, but it looks like we're supposed to take a break. Aren't we? There's no bell anymore? Oh, that's a disaster. Okay. Let's take a break now. And we'll come back and get into the doctrine itself.
Thank you for listening. For more information about how you can help Westminster continue to provide content like this without charge, please visit givewts.com or email us at communications@wts.edu.